This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. It's the 28th day of May 2010 here in Japan, and today I'm honored to be joined on the line once again by Daniel Estulin, the author and researcher behind the international best-selling book, The True Story of the Bilderberg Group. His latest book, Shadow Masters, How Governments and Their Intelligence Agencies Are Working with International Drug Dealers and Terrorists for Mutual Benefit and Profit, is available from Trinday. Daniel Estulin, thank you very much for joining me once again on the Corbett Report.
James, it's great to be with you again. Thank you for having me on your show.
Well, it's great to have you here. And as your new book has been available for a few months now, what kind of response have you been receiving so far?
Absolutely, you know, awestricken is basically what people say. They just can't believe some of the stuff. You know, floored, awestricken. I can think of a whole bunch of adjectives, but basically, you know, just a lot of the things that simply didn't make sense from reading all the mainstream publications. Suddenly, you know, the pieces kind of fall into place. When they read Shadow Masters, everything from Victor Boot's story, you know, to the drug trade, to how they tried to destroy Russia, the Litvinenko chapter makes a lot of sense. And of course, Kosovo is the epicenter of the entire drug within Europe, in a sense that, you know, the geography rules, and Kosovo is the shortest way into Europe. And again, it's without the drug trade, the entire world economy would collapse onto itself. So there are a lot of little, you know, bits and pieces and big pieces of the puzzle which help people understand, you know, the deep politics, the geopolitics of the world. And a lot of people are saying to me they will never see the world the same after reading the Shadow Masters.
Well, that's right. Having had a chance to read the book, I can definitely confirm it covers a range of very disparate material, and including an excellent analysis of the wholesale looting that took place in post-Soviet Russia, and as you mentioned, the war in Kosovo, and details about the accused merchant of death, Victor Boot. What would you say is the theme or idea that unites these subjects, and what made you take up these topics specifically?
Well, you know, Bilderberg dealt with, the planners, and I thought that behind the planners there must be the executioners, and I needed to find who they were. And when I actually, you know, went on to researching the executioners, I realized that the diaspora is, you know, quite wide. You're talking about governments, you're talking about intelligence agencies. When I say governments, obviously, you know, several levels below Bilderberg, and intelligence agencies, obviously, several levels below the government, and you have the drug traffickers, or several levels below the intelligence agencies, you have the terrorists, you know, all these, you know, there's a potpourri of scum, basically, as I call them, all working together towards the same goal. And that goal has very little to do with what we've been told in the mainstream press. And, you know, to finish my book, I've crisscrossed half of the world. And, you know, the whole, there's actually additional material which never even went into the book, which simply there was just no room for it. But, you know, I spent 3.5 years in Africa in the 1990s. You know, Canon camera in the left hand, Mac 10, in my right. I'm very familiar with Black Africa, especially Chad, Darfur, Sudan, Congo, Brazzaville, Zaire, or what's now cynically called Democratic Republic of Congo. You know, I've seen with my own eyes how the CIA and the Hezbollah work together, the same blood diamond mines, with local mafias, basically sharing the train and, you know, going out having drinks at night. You know, I know it sounds facetious and absolutely insane, but, you know, as I say when I sign my books, welcome to the parallel universe of smoke and mirrors.
Well, that's right, and one of the main focuses of the book is Victor Boot, the accused merchant of death and international gunrunner. But you take up the majority of the book with an analysis in which the frustration that you faced in attempting to discover more about this character comes across in the book very well, I think. And I'm wondering what made you start looking into him specifically, and what were you surprised about what you found, or shall we say, what you didn't find out about him?
Well, I think in the word Bilderberg, and, you know, I'm not pushing my Bilderberg book because, you know, it sold 3.5 million copies already worldwide. But the point is that, when you're talking about world government control, or actually it's more, one world company control, in the sense of what George Ball said back in 1968, corporations having much far more power than the governments on Earth. And, you know, we're seeing it right now with Greece, of course, where you have the banks, International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, and the European Central Bank giving orders to, you know, I suppose it would be free country Greece on what they have to do and how they should get their house in order. But the point is that, you know, I realized that Bilderberg, or whatever you want to call, you know, the people who control, they had two enemies on the way to world, you know, towards their, one world government control. And these are Russia and China. And China, militarily, they're not a very strong enemy simply because technologically, they just don't have the technology to oppose, you know, the NATO alliance or the United States. For example, they don't even know how to, they don't have the technology to make a mini nuclear weapon. You call it a dirty nuke, call it a suitcase nuke, but only four nations in the world know how to do that. That's the Soviet Union, the United States, France, and Israel. So again, you know, China militarily, they're just, you know, they're not a competitor. The only nation that really stands in the, in the way of this complete domination by the Shadow Masters is Russia, which is why they've been at it for so long trying to destroy it. You know, going back to World War II, you had Operation Barbarossa 1, you had during the Yeltsin years when the Soviet Union fell apart in 1991, you had Barbarossa 2, which was basically, you know, a takeover of Russia, as I described in the chapter, The Economic Rape of Russia, by the NGOs, by the think tanks, foundations, and all these, you know, agencies which allegedly were working, you know, hand in glove with the Russians to help them, you know, get back or find democracy, where there's, in fact, as, you know, you see in that chapter, all of them working towards the goal to loot Russia, to destroy from the inside, because they understood that militarily it would have to be the last, you know, part of the plan, not the first. And when that failed, basically when the KGB took over with Putin at the helm, you know, they put the new plan in order. That was Barbarossa 3. And that's where Victor Boot comes in as a character, because, you know, what I discovered, and again, I talk about it in the last chapter of the book, and it's, again, it's you know, it's all, you know, all that I ever discovered this, because I got a, you know, one of my sources got called me in the United States government and said, look what you're missing. I mean, you're not seeing the whole picture. And that's when I went back and went over the entire process, you know, of the United States government attempt to ensnare Booth, going back to the early 1990s. And I realized what they're trying to do is they're trying to accuse him of trafficking in nuclear components. And the understanding is obviously that Victor Booth, the merchant of death, could only get his hands on nuclear components if the Soviet Union or Russia is actually standing behind him and feeding these nuclear components, you know, to the FARC terrorists, to anybody who's actually willing to buy them and spend money. So the idea is that if you can destroy Russia, you know, economically, if you put them in the same sentence, you know, as North Korea, as Iran, as, you know, as Cuba, as Venezuela, you can destroy their credibility. And obviously, you know, from a diplomatic point of view, it'll be a major victory for the United States. And also another point, a very key element is that actually, you know, came across Booth several times in Africa, in my travels, you know, through Africa in those years, is that Victor Booth got a start, you know, back in 1991. When the Soviet Union fell apart, he was working as a translator. He was never KGB anything. You know, it was just a made-up story, like, you know, Winnie the Pooh. He was working as a translator out of Mozambique for the Russian government in the consulate. And when the country fell apart, instead of going back, he stayed in Africa because his love was airplanes and Africa. He loved, you know, the continent. He basically, him and his brother Sergei, they bought a couple of, you know, used secondhand Antonov 24s, which you can pick up for about $250,000. You know, in money terms, it's not a lot of money. It'd be the price of a mid-range, you know, good quality Mercedes Benz, which is really not a lot of money for a cargo plane. And they started moving things, you know, from point A to point B. They became the transporters. And they moved everything from ostriches to ostrich eggs, you know, elephants, zebras, arms, you know what I mean? But, you know, arms trafficking is not illegal. It's legal. Anybody can do it. It's just governments don't want you to do it because then they lose money. Okay, but it's a legal business. Whether you and I agree with it or not, it is legal. Well, basically, it happened also in the 1990s. The entire African continent was a blaze of wars, yet 32 out of the 53 countries at war with each other, local, regional conflicts, you know, and so all the Western airliners, they literally pulled out, leaving all the Africans to their own devices. So you had 1 billion people on the continent without food, without access to medicine, without clothes. And so Victor Booth and his kamikaze, you know, pickle-eating Ruskies, who basically lost their job when the Soviet Union fell apart, you know, they just, you know, stepped right in and filled the void. And what happened, you know, 2-3 years later, by about end of 1995, 1996, which was when I was, you know, in Africa, is Victor Booth controlled 90% of the continent, which, you know, in the mega monopoly terms, not even Microsoft could ever dream of having such a monopoly. And then when, you know, beginning in 1997, when the wars began to subside and all these Western governments wanted to come back, they suddenly realized that then all their access, all the doors were closed to them because, yeah, this Ruski by the name of Victor Booth, who controlled the entire market, and needless to say, Africa is the epicenter of the entire world struggle because it's the breadbasket of the world. It has all the natural resources. It has land to feed the entire planet. So if you're the United States government, if you're the United Nations controlled by the United States government, if you're the British government, you can't afford to have this guy in there. You got to get him out, you know, because you need to have wars, you need to gather the natural resources, you need to put the NGOs on the ground, you need to put, you know, all these organizations on the ground under the control and the auspices of the Americans. Now, the only way to do that is to vilify a Victor Booth. So that's how they created this myth, you know, about a merchant of death allegedly selling weapons to the entire continent, except that, as I show in my book, you know, all of it is, you know, is a giant lie. And the American government, my sources in the State Department told me that the American government is profoundly upset at the fact that, you know, after all these things that I've done, which never included these types of research, I suddenly decide one good day to get on a plane, go to Thailand, spend 6 months there, you know, and destroy what the Americans have been working on for the last 16 years and have spent over $80 million, you know, on trying to vilify this man, literally destroy it in 6 months, you know, of my investigation.
Well, I'll leave it to the listeners to go and get the book and to read it for themselves, but certainly it does come across very clearly how the Shadow Masters are capable of creating a myth, creating a character out of whole cloth and assigning it to someone. It's quite a revealing analysis in that respect. But I'd like to turn to one of my favorite passages from the book, which actually comes from the preface. And in it you say, quote, evil in all of its manifestations should be literally unspeakable. If we need to debate, even in the name of freedom and democracy, the legitimacy of evil deeds like torture, as we are being asked to do, if we must debate these things, we are already lost, end quote. And I thought that was a particularly telling piece of analysis, and I think it's quite true. But in the end, what does that say about what we're doing in trying to raise awareness about this evil?
I don't know. You know, I think we're doing the best we can. I'm just not sure exactly. You know, if I knew the answer to that question, I just may get into politics. You know, I think my job as a writer is, you know, Graham Greene used to say his loyalties changed because, you know, the victims changed. And that's basically how I feel. You know, the victims in Bilderberg are different than the victims of the Shadow Masters. And you know, a lot of people don't understand how I can feel a certain degree of sympathy and empathy for a character like Victor Booth. Well, I've met him. I spent 6 months with him, and he's in prison, locked up in Quang Prem, the worst prison of Southeast Asia, in Bangkok. They call it the Bangkok Hilton, you know. And, you know, so I do feel a lot of sympathy and a lot of respect for the man, not because he dealt arms, but, you know, because, you know, he is a Patsy. And had there not been a Victor Booth, it simply would have created another character, which they would have named the Victor Booth, because, you know, it's literally it's a long-range objective, because what they've actually wanted us to believe is that one man, a Victor Booth, is more intelligent, smarter, and, you know, and can outwit the United States government, the United Kingdom government, the Interpol, the United Nations, you know, every security agency in the world, the Echelon system, PROMIS, and, you know, NSA, the Office of Naval Intelligence, and all these agencies are helpless, you know, in the face of Victor Booth, who is smarter than all of them put together. Now, my question literally was, why are they leading us down this path? Like, you know, this is going way, way down the rabbit hole, and it's the wrong hole. Why are they taking us there? And, you know, again, it's amazing, as I prove in the book, and if it ever goes to trial, this case in the United States, because Booth won the first case, now it's an appeals case. If he loses, he'll be extradited to the United States. But the evidence we have against the people who actually put him in prison is astounding. Douglas Farah, one of the leading American journalists, you know, former Washington Post reporter in Western Africa, and then written a book called The Merchant of Death. You know, he perjured himself twice, you know, in Congress, you know, under oath, making up evidence which literally, you know, basically vilified Booth to the point where he could only be compared to a Hitler or, you know, Mao Zedong. And as I show in the book, it's all a lie. The man who was a district attorney, assistant district attorney in the United States, and the chief of DEA officer in Bangkok by the name of, Derek Ordney. He offered on tape and on video to a former Russian nuclear intelligence officer by the name of Dmitry Halizov, who's been at the time working on Victor Booth's defense, you know, any amount of money he wanted if he could just get out of the way or at least help sabotage Victor Booth's defense. Now, why would these people do that? You know, they have this, you know, airshot case against the man who they allegedly been pursuing for the past 15 years since 1996. You know, finally, again, it's absolutely amazing. The Victor Booth's second lawyer is actually literally and directly working for the DEA, and Booth and his team simply are not smart enough or you spend too much time in prison, or I don't know what the story is, but they simply don't understand, you know, what is being done to them.
Well, that's exactly right, and the people will perish for lack of knowledge, but it's certainly telling that whenever we see these figures that are supposedly doing things that normal people would never, ever be able to pull off, it's generally a good sign that the Shadow Masters are in operation behind the scenes. So in that, in that regard, was there any sections or any people that you were looking at or any topics that were left out of the book?
Well, you know, I think the section on Russia is also very telling. Again, what you're seeing right now is, you know, wholesale intent to destroy Russia as a nation and also destroy Russia as a continent, as a country, you know, as a force, because without Russia in the way, these people are going to be much, much closer towards towards creating their one world government, new world order, one world company limited, whatever you want. As you know, as I say in the book, this destabilization of the Russian state became the goal of the Shadow Masters after the collapse of the Soviet Union in December 1991, and I explained in a chapter, and you know, we've talked about this before, and you said you liked it very, very much. It's, you know, just how many people and how many organizations were actually working actively with the mafias, not only American but Italian mafia and Russian mafia, of course, in trying to destabilize and take Russia apart. Not only that, but also with the help of the same KGB, who allegedly and supposedly was, you know, on the Russian side, vying for the security of the country itself. But in reality, you know, they're all working, you know, towards their whatever long-range objectives, individual objectives were. But certainly, you know, had Putin not come into power, I don't think there would have been left very much of Russia as a nation.
Yes, I found that particularly fascinating. It really did change the way that I looked at the whole post-Soviet Russia collapse and what the way we've been shown it in the Western establishment media. So definitely my hat's off to you for that research. Extremely interesting. Well, just as a further testament to the incredible work that you're doing and the response that you're getting, we get an PR from PR Web last week, just showing that, again, you're having an incredible effect, and you are apparently going to be making an unprecedented speech before the European Parliament on June 1st at its headquarters
in
Brussels.
Right.
Tell us about that.
That's right. That's coming up. Well, you know, that's an amazing story in itself, because, you know, Bilderberg has for such a long time, as you so well know, there's been a mainstream of, you know, of conspiracy crazies and, you know, and freaks who believe in, you know, the Illuminati, you know, Jewish Masonic conspiracy controls the world, you know, with an evil, you know, devil eye behind the scenes, albeit lizard people, or, you know, whatever these people actually, and, you know, their imagination takes them. But, you know, in fact, that, you know, Bilderberg is an organization. It's not a secret society. You know, it's a private organization, and they've been around for a very long time. But what I've done in all the years of research is actually show that, you know, there's logic and reason to why things work the way they do. And, I published my Italian version of Bilderberg back in, I think, about a year and a half ago. And about 6 months ago, an Italian senator by the name of Mario Bugessio, who would be like an equivalent of American Jesse Helms. You know, big, loud, noisy, extremely effective speaker, very dangerous, and also at the same time very, very polemic. He found my book. He came across my book. And after reading it, first of all, he had no idea that Bilderberg existed. Second of all, when he found out that they existed and what they actually planned from behind the scenes, you know, became enraged and incensed. And then I came to Italy in November, late November last year. He came to my conference and he said he was going to invite me to speak at the European Parliament. And this is basically how the invitation came about. I saw a YouTube video of Mario Borghesio standing up in front of the European Parliament with my book in hand and saying, you know, Von Rumpy, the president of the European who elected these people? You know, he was saying, do you not realize that all of these politicians, you know, Milburn, Von Rumpy, Lady Ashton, they all belong to Bilderberg Trilateral Commission, Council of Foreign Relations. You know, it's very interesting, you know, to watch the body language of the president of European Parliament sitting there scratching his cheek, you know, trying to keep a straight face when he very well knew what Mario Borghesi was talking about. So here I am next week on Tuesday making this unprecedented historic speech at the European Parliament, you know, along with Mario Borghesi, Nigel Farage from the United Kingdom Independent Party, and a few other very important European politicians. Again, it has long, you know, been a domain of the conspiracy crazies. It is no longer that. It's no longer the back alleys. It's now absolutely mainstream. We have Bilderberg Conference next week in Spain. We have 37 television crews coming from across the world. Bilderbergers and their mainstream media puppets are going to have a very, very difficult time trying to convince the world that Russia Today and Company is actually conspiracy theory channels.
Well, I certainly hope they will have a difficult time with that, but they're obviously going to try their best. And so tell us about this year's Bilderberg Conference.
Well, as always, I mean, you know, I'm a little bit disappointed in the Bilderbergers lately because we've infiltrated them so long time ago that now, you know, I would think that, you know, they would have taken certain precautions and measures, especially coming, you know, to my part of the world. But obviously, or they don't care, or they simply become careless or too old, or whatever the story is. But, you know, a few days ago, I received from my sources a Bilderberg meeting agenda items, which I very much like to share with your listeners.
Please do.
Okay, well, number one on the agenda is, will the euro survive? Question mark. Needless to say, they're very concerned about the euro. It's interesting that Greece is not the issue. It's the euro survival an issue. And again, what they don't seem to understand, and what I have been pushing in Spain in numerous interviews I've been doing over the past few weeks, is trying to convince the politicians and the people that, you know, the solution is for us Spaniards and the Greek and the Portuguese and the Italian, basically leave Europe, because again, it's not about, you know, keeping the euro as a currency. It's about being a nation state republic. It's about working together, going back, you know, to being the fatherland of nations, the Charles de Gaulle concept, which has nothing to do with the Bilderbergers and the European Union trying to put together a monetary union, which simply doesn't work. Number two is developments in Europe, Europe's exit strategy, ... on hold, question mark. Now, a brief explanation. The markets are also starting to recognize that the monetary policy impact that the struggling Eurozone constituents will have on the European Central Bank's ability to reverse ultra-easy money conditions. Now, with aggressive austerity plans facing Greece, Spain, Portugal, and Ireland, a risk of a double-dip recession for the Eurozone rises dramatically, just as I accurately predicted immediately following Bilderberg 2009 in Greece on your show, James, if you remember.
I remember it very well, certainly, yes.
Well, and here we go, you know, number three. Do we have the institutions to deal with the world economy? So needless to say, they're concerned whether they have enough power internationally to deal with the current crisis. Number four, Greece. Lessons and forward-looking strategies. Very interesting. It's not number one point on the agenda. It's number four. Number five, NATO and Afghanistan, the practical agenda for the alliance. Again, NATO and Afghanistan. There's only one thing in Afghanistan worth anything at all. That's drugs. And needless to say, the NATO alliance is there making sure that the drugs make their way safely into Wall Street, because, again, the drugs are washed through Wall Street. That's a $700 billion a year cash business. If you eradicate drugs or if you legalize them, the entire world economy will collapse onto itself. So needless to say, a very interesting key point on the Bilderberger agenda. And, again, interesting also to keep in mind that all the royal houses, of course, are represented at the Bilderberg conferences, and the British Crown has been into the drug trade, you know, going back to the British East India Company and China. So needless to say, they are very familiar with drugs and making money from drugs. Number six, Iran and Russia, economic and financial threats to the alliance. Again, Iran is a diversion. The key element of the entire thing is Russia. The United States is building 13 super secret bases in Afghanistan, all of them bigger than the rest of the bases anywhere in the world. Again, Iran is a diversion. It's Russia that they're after. If there's going to be a preemptive attack, Russia is obviously from the south. It's going to get hit very, very hard. And all of these 13 bases are going to house a very important contingent of NATO soldiers. Number seven, the consequences of war against terrorism. Number eight, the influence of domestic issues on American foreign policy. Number nine, the outlook for Japan's economy. Very interesting, knowing that you live in Japan. I'll certainly get back to you, you know, with what they said about that. And number 10, the future of U.S. dollar, alternative scenarios. And I got, you know, from our sources in Bilderberg, clarification on that issue. Bilderberg is basically, as I said on your show last year, is positioning itself to destroy the U.S. dollar. And according to my source in Bilderberg, who stated candidly that, and I quote, the Obama government may not be in the position to do anything about it. Now, again, as I said a long time ago, if the United States dollar plunged, the collapse of the fictitious mass of outstanding dollar-denominated internal credit brought about by either devaluation or a hyperinflation of what are nominally U.S. dollar-denominated obligations would in itself prompt the sudden collapse of the entire world physical economy into a generation-long global new dark age of our planet as a whole. Now I'm just going to say it one more time. If ratified, the Bilderberg Plan would result in a virtually certain destruction of the United States. We talked about this, you and I, when I was in Thailand, right, during the G20 meeting in November when they tried to pull that stunt off, except that the Russians and the Chinese told them to, you know, pound sand. And, you know, this has been the treasonous intent of this Bilderberg Group since its first meeting back in 1954. Again, it's important to understand, if listeners are wondering why the American delegates are not doing anything about it, is that they're part of the plan. They're treacherous, you know, and treasonous folks. They don't represent us, the people, and they certainly don't represent our governments. They work for a cabal known as the Bilderbergers, who also have, you know, very powerful interests above them, but basically, again, these secret private organizations, their idea is to destroy the world economy, and that's what we see right now. You know, the entire collapse, monetary, systemic collapse witnessing right now is part of a long-range plan, you know, to usher in this age of One World Company Limited.
Absolutely right, and absolutely fascinating that you've done it once again. You've cracked the nut, and you've gotten the inside information. So thank you so much for sharing that again with my listeners. And as we're wrapping up here, I'd like to contemplate the possibility that the increased scrutiny of Bilderberg over the recent years has actually caused Bilderberg as a talking shop to perhaps decrease in importance, because we know that the Bilderberg Steering Committee has always been the more important core nucleus of the group, where the real decisions are really made. And is it possible that now that it's coming in the light of scrutiny, the shadow masters are just retreating to an even further level of secrecy that we're unable to penetrate?
Well, you know, the steering committee has always been a tough nut to crack, and it's such a small group of insiders that I've never had any sources. Obviously, I mean, we're talking about a group of six people, but you know, we have had amazing success with people who are very close to the steering committee. It's true what you're saying, that they're probably going to retreat even further to a cocoon, but it's also true that, you know, the meeting themselves, you know, to most people, especially attendees who don't understand that there's a very concrete structure behind these meetings, historical structures, who just, you know, come once and see a chance, you know, to talk to David Rockefeller or rub shoulders with Henry Kissinger as an opportunity of a lifetime. And so, the real decisions, for example, you know, the drug trade in Afghanistan is not going to be discussed at an open meeting. It's going to be discussed behind closed doors by a much smaller group of people. And the real decisions are made, as you said, you know, the steering committee. And needless to say, you know, what's today called the Bilderberg Group, they actually founded by, you know, the Synarchist Movement of Empires, which is Marxist esoteric, you know, cult. And the Synarchists, the Martinists, you know, they created, you know, the Synarchism as a kind of a counterattack against the principles upon which the United States as a nation was built. So, you know, it's very, very possible that they're going to retreat even further. But again, they still, you know, need a substantial group of people, meaning 100, 120 people, to make some of these decisions, at least on a, you know, superficial level. So as long as they keep doing this, we'll always have inside track into what they're talking about, unless they decide to meet underground, hopefully in hell, and then in which case, you know, we just may not get any access to what they're talking about. But up to now, we've certainly had no trouble whatsoever infiltrating them as a group.
Well, that is excellent, and it is a sign that we are having such an effect now, and you are having such an effect on a personal level, so we are definitely looking forward to your speech before European Parliament next week, and wish you all the best with that. So,
again, I'll track it back. I'll certainly report back to you on what was said and who said what to whom, and how these people feel about what we're doing.
Awesome. Well, I'm looking forward to that, as are my listeners, I'm sure. Is there any final thought you'd like to leave the listeners with today?
No, I think, you know, the importance is that, again, discerning listeners should understand that the world is run not by governments, by the people above governments, and people like Barack Obama are only allowed into the White House because they've been bought and paid for long before they became presidents. Otherwise, you know, nobody makes it into the White House because it's too important a position. Well, I just want to make sure that people start using their heads. They have to start thinking critically. Everything that they watch on television has to analyze scrupulously from different points of view. Why are they telling us something? Why is it being shown a particular way? Because, again, CNN and all these other organizations do not represent the people. They work for the elite, which is why if anything ever appears on television, we have to make sure we understand and we don't let, you know, be deceived by them. And if you can afford to buy my new book, The Shadow Masters, please do. We're all so very close on Amazon.com to get to number one. We're at about 200. If we can push it to number one, or we can push it to the top 10 on Amazon, New York Times will have no choice but to put me on their bestseller list, because otherwise, you know, the little horns will be showing, so they'll have no choice to do that. And if we ever get it to the New York Times top 10 list, I guarantee you that the book will explode. If it has sold about 100,000 copies in 2 months, just imagine what it will do if it gets to the New York Times bestseller list.
Absolutely. Very, very important. And I certainly hope everyone is buying copies from Amazon to try to push it up on that ratings list. Is there a website for the book?
Yes. You can go to my webpage. It's danielustulin.com. It's in Spanish right now. We're putting a English webpage on next week. I was on Coast to Coast 3 days ago. We had 470,000 people come to my site. The webpage crashed. We simply were not prepared for that kind of traffic. So again, a lot of things are going on. There's I'm not as sure if it's a tectonic plate or the full moon, but certainly, you know, there's this new awareness, and even Zbigniew Brzezinski, you know, to his own chagrin, had to admit that, you know, something is giving way, and people are beginning to wake up, and maybe this is the right moment. And, you know, if I'm the catalyst for it, well, that's great. You know, but I certainly hope there are other people out there doing their bit, because we need a lot more than just one leader to get this thing through.
Well, that's right. We certainly can't put all our eggs in one basket, but if we only had one basket, I think your basket would be a pretty good one to put our eggs in. At any rate, I certainly look forward to your reporting on Bilderberg this year, and it certainly keep us informed. So, Daniel Estulin, thank you so much for everything you're doing.
Take care.